live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley, and also on Periscope, at Total Tutor. Let the continued, the top celebrity guests, really, really fun last couple of weeks. Best shows, I guess, on television. We'll continue that process. I guess the number one show, so I'm excited to welcome the program from AMC's hit TV show, The Walking Dead, Anne Mahoney. Anne, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm excited to have you on the show as well. And I always like to break down in our interviews, just really go really into why you want to become an actor. And we'll go right into that. Specifically, was acting in your blood your whole life, or tell us how that worked?
I actually started as a dancer when I was around 4 years old. I'm from a family of musicians, but not actors. But pretty soon when I was 10, I did my first play and was hooked. And so then all through high school, I did speech and debate. And then I went and got my bachelor's degree in acting and also my master's in acting. So I've really studied the craft most of my life. And so it's my favorite thing, and I feel blessed to be able to do it professionally.
And so, and starting out, I guess it's like every other actor, it's a process, right? You get smaller roles, opportunities throughout your career, doing from the stage to film and TV, and finally that big break comes, right? And that's how it pretty much works, doesn't it?
And that's how it works. I know a few and far between stories of people who are, you know, at a cafe having a tea and got, you know, discovered. But the majority of the stories that I know are like mine, which is just people who are really love the craft, dedicate themselves to, you know, working on that, and then are tenacious and just keep going, even when people tell them that they can't do it. And then the right opportunity comes along one day, and then it opens up wide for you like it has for me since Walking Dead.
So before that, what was your big break? I always like to find out so people would say, okay, before Anne was on The Walking Dead, tell me specifically what would you say was your biggest role before that?
Oof. Probably Big Mama's House 2. And then after that, probably Heart of Dixie when I did the pilot of that. But it was not, for me, it was not like a clear shot. Walking Dead was pretty much the thing that has landed me being able to do interviews like this and all the other stuff that's happening now, you know. Before that, I did a lot of theater, and I don't know how familiar the audience is with those theater places, but my breaks there were at the Berkshire Theater Festival, off-Broadway with My Yee Theater Company, and regionally with Long Wharf Theater. So, you know, it's been a long time coming. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but I've been working on it for a long time.
Well, I interview a variety of actors and actresses all the time, and they get that story, and then they have that break. You look at these different sitcoms, and you're like, well, I've never heard of this person. Now they're a breakout. If you go back into their careers, check out their IMDb, they had those different roles, and then the right role came. So tell us specifically, I guess, the story of The Walking Dead. So how did this happen? You know, the show is so huge, and how the opportunity came to be on the show. Was it just the circumstance? Your agent said, hey, this will be great for you, or how did this happen?
Well, the neat thing is that one of my favorite acting books is called Audition for Your Career, Not the Job. And so this does tie in, I promise. Thing Cannon and Associates, they do a ton of casting out of the Southeast. They've cast a bunch of stuff you've heard of, The Blind Side, most recently Oscar winning, and Ray, and all kinds of stuff. Well,
yes.
When I met them, I had first started doing film and television. And at that time, you could still get an in-person meeting with an agent or with a casting director. Now it's a lot harder. So I kind of, you know, lucked into the end of that kind of era. And I met Lisa Mae Fincannon, and she and I just really responded to each other right off of that. So they were responsible for casting me in the majority of the major stuff that I've done, including Big Mama's House 2 and Heart of Dixie and now The Walking Dead. So when the breakdown came out that they were looking for this recurring character, and they don't give the real name.
Right.
And they described her, you know, they said, I think that this would be great for Anne. And I taped it and I sent it in and I was cast from tape, probably on the word of Lisa May Fincannon and Fincannon Associates, where they just said she's a lovely person. She's wonderful to work with, very into the craft. So I got cast. It was like a Friday night. I was at the symphony with my mom. And I got a phone call from my agent, which is weird. It was 7:30 or so in the evening. So I was like, at the intermission, I called her back. And she said, they want to cast you in The Walking Dead. I was like, whoa, okay. I said, do we know my character's name yet? She said, no. So I didn't even know her name. They don't. The audition sides are not from the show. They're they write them separately. So I had to be in Georgia by Sunday. So I went to Georgia. The first person I met was Yulin, who does costumes. And so I'm looking at all her pictures on the wall of, like, her whole Olivia Pinterest board, basically, that she does. And she's telling me, your character this and your character that. And I'm like, what is my character's name? She said, Olivia. I was like, okay, Olivia. So, because I'm one of those actors who I love to do background work and research, and yes. I like to understand. You know, I've lost a lot of my notebooks in Hurricane Katrina, but I have notebooks. I did used to have notebooks for characters I played even back in high school. So I'm writing all this stuff down. And then they're like, oh, you have a meeting with Greg Nicotero and Scott Gimple. And I'm like, oh, my Lord. At which point I called my agents and I said, I think this is a big deal. I think it's a big deal because I've never sat down with the executive producer of anything before. So I sat down with them. They started to give me a little bit of background of who she was and how she might come into play in the show and sort of how long she would be around. They did tell me at that time that she's still alive in the comic books. This was a year ago. And I was like, wow. So then I shot, my first day of shooting was Tuesday, and this was Monday. And so the props guy, John, who's just, he came and took my glasses. He's like, let me go see if I can find some more of these because it could be years and we need several pairs. And as soon as your face shows up on the show, everybody's going to want these glasses. And I mean, I have two little kids, so I hadn't really watched much of the show by then, so it was a real steep learning curve for me. I'm like, everybody's going to want the glasses? I don't understand. So, they took my glasses. They even took me for an eye exam, got me some a new prescription, and those my glasses live on set now. And they made me another pair of take-home. And then Tuesday was my first shooting day, and I was just like all day Monday, all night. I was like, I have to sleep too, but I was just doing my homework and,
yep.
You know, working on that. Yeah, so that's how it happened. It was a whirlwind, and yeah, it was a whirlwind. It was amazing.
Well, it definitely seems like it, and to know that your character's still living on at this point, and to know just specifically you're going to be part of a cult classic forever. Because you know, whenever the show does run its course, it will be never forgotten. Because when fans become fans of a show, they're fans of that show for life. And I'm sure once you got finally, you know, it aired, your life changed a lot. Being recognized, being contacted via social media, it was a big change, wasn't it?
It was a huge change. So when it started airing, it was like I had 300 Twitter followers, and like overnight it went to 3,500, and then midway through the summer it was like 20,000, and now it's like 30,000. Like,
right.
I can't get Twitter to verify me, though. I don't know why they won't verify
me. Oh, and I'm going to tell you about that. That's a very interesting situation. A lot has to do with your whoever the company is. If it's AMC, if it's somebody, a lot of them only have a certain amount that can get verified in each production, so I would contact them if you're going to look at it.
They
don't, sort of doesn't do it themselves. A lot of it has to do with money, certain things. I've had clients I've talked to before, you know, I do social media and branding for companies, and I'm like, you know, why can't I get verified, da, 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 and then we found out the process. I'm working with someone from TLC right now, and they said, well, why didn't you verify us? Well, we only had X amount of people we could go after and verify in TLC, so some we could take a look at. So it's not a big, it's big thing as long as you're live tweeting when the show's airing, then you're going to be as a big star as the rest that are verified. So remember that.
Okay.
So, I mean, just as long as you're present and you're present with your fans, you're going to be fine.
I'm definitely present with my fans. I mean, I know how much I owe to them. It's just, like, to have them embrace this character has been a revelation, you know? And as a plus-size actress, too, it's like,
yes.
They're like, we're so glad to see a girl who looks like us on the show. Now, all the girls on that show are really healthy. Having worked in a lot of film in my life, I can say the girls on this show are really strong and healthy. And that's nice. That's a nice change.
Yes.
But I'm still, you know, I'm still the plus-size girl on the show.
Exactly. So tell us about your character. I have a lot of other things about Anna Mahoney that people want to learn about today. But let's just learn about your character a little bit more, specifically the role. Then I know we can't talk about the current Walking Dead. Trust me, I understand that. But we can talk about your new movie coming up and also how you work with kids in acting. You have a lot of different projects. So let's first jump right into specifically your character for people. To be honest, I've watched The Walking Dead once for my wife because all the people, I was a former professional wrestler, I see Walking Dead every night, okay? And I'm like, okay, let's tune in and watch this. And I think you got to be watching it from the beginning of the season or you'll get lost in specific things. But tell us a bit about your character.
Well, you know, there's something about Olivia that people trust her. You know, the gang has come from Terminus, where that was the last place they turned their weapons in. And we all know, if you've watched the show, how well that turned out. and so for them to come to Alexandria and have to hand over all their weapons to me, and for them to do it, and for Rick to initiate that, is a very big vote of confidence in who Olivia is. So that's something, that's one of the first things Yulin told me even before I knew the name of my character, which was, there's something about you that is very trustworthy, and there's something that feels peaceful about you, and that's why they're not afraid to do that. So that's the big thing for me, is Olivia is a peacemaker. You know, even though she runs the armory and the pantry and rations the food and signs the guns in and out, she really wants peace and order and for people to be fair and kind to one another. So that's the basis of who she is. Now, whether or not that's going to serve her as things get out of hand in Alexandria is another question.
And that's again, the people that are into the comic book checkout and all these different things, where your character's going in that process for sure. And I guess being thrown into the mix of the show and in so many ways that your life changed, how much do you get recognized going around places all the time now than before? it's so crazy.
You know, what's funny is that on the show I mean, literally no makeup. There is no makeup
right.
on me. And in real life, I tend to wear makeup. So it's actually been serving me pretty well. I get noticed, you know what I get noticed a lot is at the airport in Atlanta.
Oh, really? Okay.
You know what I mean? Like the rental car people are like, oh my God, you're Olivia. You play Olivia, the one you said. But I think I haven't been as visible in the show enough yet to where it's become weird yet.
But the season could be it.
Well, and I have great neighbors and great family. I live in New Orleans, and they're all kind of nonplussed by it because they've all known me since I was, you know, a baby. So they're like,
right.
Oh, it's so cool. This is working out for you, you know? So.
Fantastic. All right, so let's go to some other stuff you're doing. And, again, so your character could definitely evolve more this season, so we have to stay tuned for the premiere for sure and see what happens, right? Correct?
Yes.
And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But let's go right into your talking about, first of all, coming up to the premiere, your dress. That's an interesting thing to talk about. There's a bunch of different things. Yeah, tell us about your dress.
Well, of course, as soon as I got invited, as any woman does, I went, oh, no, what am I going to wear? And because once again, I used to have some four-length gowns, but they all got wrecked in Katrina. So I was like, oh, what am I going to wear? And then I had just been reading this story about Melissa McBride. I do this every time because Melissa McBride is on my brain. Melissa McCarthy, when she was nominated for an Oscar for Bridesmaids, no designer would design for her because she was plus-sized. I just thought, if no one will design for Melissa McCarthy, I'm screwed. You know, like,
yeah.
It's like, you're never going to happen. So I was like, you know what, I'll just do some research. And I looked up up-and-coming couture designers. So that's what I Googled. And I spent like 7 or 8 hours looking at stuff. And it was okay. But I landed on this one designer, Andrew Dierdahl, and his name is D-Y-R-D-A-H-L. And he's got a theater background, which I like. He does a lot of corset, and then he had these magnificent parachute dresses that he was making. I thought, man, how appropriate for The Walking Dead, you know, a parachute dress. And so I had my manager call him, and I said, you know, to my manager, you need to tell him I'm plus size because I don't want to get into this process and then have him say, oh, I don't really want to, you know, I can't design for you because you're plus size. Or I don't know if they would say that directly, but so he told him, and Andrew's response made my jaw drop because he immediately said, well, that's great because then, you know, normal women can see what my dress would look like on them. So he's a big fan of the show. So he immediately said yes.
Great.
So, yeah, so he's making this dress for me. We're actually meeting up in New York on Wednesday. He's going to do a final couple fittings. And then it's going to debut on the red carpet. It's going to be his first big debut for this type of dress. And then Amber Hatchett, who's a jewelry designer out of Asheville, North Carolina, made me a custom necklace out of 9 millimeter shells.
Wow.
So I've got a survival kind of theme going.
That's cool. And then that'll make you different on the carpet. And then also, what a big thing for sure to differentiate yourself. Because like you said, when you said Melissa McCarthy and what she's gone through, where they couldn't find a dress designer and all this stuff, we have to change the way we think about it. And it's very interesting you said about the women and how none of them are really, 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 you know, petite, never had a meal ever type of situation on The Walking Dead. But for people to understand, regardless of their size, they could be a star someday. You know, I think that's definitely a role model for women who, oh, you know, you can't be this way. And you're definitely breaking those barriers because we all know what Hollywood can do in different things for sure. Now, one of the interesting things, Total Education Network, I find is, again, that you teach kids acting. Now, have you've been doing this for a while, I'm sure, before you had your big break. I know because, again, like I tell, I hear these stories about that at times we got to figure out other ways of doing something. You see your passion. So tell us a little bit about what you do with that.
So I teach college. So I'm teaching a film acting class in the spring at Loyola University down here in New Orleans. And then I have two kids. One of them is a second grader at a charter school here in New Orleans that's called Bricolage Academy. It's actually going up in years. And anyway, I'm teaching there. I'm starting their theater program because it's a new school. They have, and it's public school. They have limited funding. So I'm doing their theater program. And so I'm really trying to make it super professional. We're using all the correct terms. And we had a big kindergarten through second grade production meeting yesterday or the last week, which was hilarious. And I was teaching
fantastic
them about production meetings, you know, and who's the scenic designer and the props master and all that stuff. And they're really digging it. Kids are amazing. And it's so rewarding. Like one of the moms sent me a picture last week of her daughter with her script in her hand. And she wrote, I can't get her to stop memorizing lines and eat breakfast. And I just thought, yes. Next generation, got
it. Isn't it motivating, especially where they wouldn't have this opportunity, to see when kids really get it? Teaching kids is such a a rewarding thing, because once that light bulb comes on and they get it, as a teacher, you feel such satisfaction.
It's nothing like it. Nothing like it.
But you said the kids that you're teaching, how many of them watch The Walking Dead?
None of them watch the show. I love little kids, too, because, like, they just don't care. You know, if they were like, your teacher's on The Walking Dead, they would be like, is that Pokemon? Or, you know what I mean? They'd be like, is that Pokemon?
You know what's sad? My wife teaches kindergarten. I want to ask how many kids watch The Walking Dead in her kindergarten. And she's in a Catholic school. I'm going to laugh and say that one to my wife. Say, so not many of them have tuned in then of your classmates that you're teaching, your students?
No, none of them watch it. One little girl was like, my mom told me you're on The Walking Dead. I was like, yeah. She's like, all right, see you later.
Wow. So that's an amazing thing. And then I guess from this opportunity, other gigs are happening, right? So let's talk about your latest movie, your new movie, 99 Homes. And, and so how did this happen? And again, this is just based on, I'm sure, the experience of The Walking Dead. Now you're being asked, you're getting a lot more opportunities when you're not filming for The Walking Dead to get some more work, correct? I'm sure you were working before, but now you're getting the top of the list of casting directors now, kind of,
it's
right?
It's really exciting. I don't know if have you gotten to see, I don't know if you've seen it yet. But,
No, I'm not. Yeah.
Oh, such a good film. It's all about the subprime mortgage crisis. And it's really a great film. And I'm in that. I'm one of the major evictions in the show. And it was very, very raw. It was
raw.
It's a very raw experience. You know, there is something to, you know, having been through Katrina. I was in New York for 9/11. I was in New Orleans for Katrina. Being through those two events, you know, I feel like I can access very quickly the raw emotion that comes with trying to survive and thinking you're going to lose your home, you know? So that's an astounding movie. Andrew Garfield and I had to have that scene together, and he just is scintillating, you know? The two of us together, I just was like, I knew I could go wherever I needed to go, and he was going to follow, and it was just, that was awesome. So that's, I think, in theaters now. And then next February, there's a film called Same Kind of Different. It's me that I did with Renee Zellweger and Greg Kinnear and who else is it? Don Voight. And I play a really, really different character in that, and a lot of physical changes in that one. And that was a huge, wonderful challenge. So that's coming out in February. And I'm looking for more work like that. You know, I really would like to be challenged as an actress. That's what I like to do.
Well, that's huge as an actress, to do those things. And then the opportunities, because we don't know how long your character's going to last. We can't say anything on that whole end. But then you got to be ready for your next gig. And then the next one could be even a larger role or even another big opportunity. And that's the thing. You constantly have to strive for your career and continue to be willing to be open to do other things. So you see that definitely the doors are opening, and especially we talked about the cast for your next film. Wow, to work with those talented actors and actresses, it must be amazing, isn't it?
And Renee Zellweger, who I had the majority of my scenes with, she's a star. She's absolutely a star, but she's also just a very, just a lovely, humble, centered person. And to be that way, given all of the success she's had in her life, I think takes amazing strength of character. So she's an extraordinary human being, extraordinary.
Well, definitely. And that's the interesting thing. You watch them on television. You might have met them one time before. But once you work with them, you see they're just the same as we are. It's just that the breaks have happened at certain times, and they're very talented. And then you get to see and say, you know what? I learned so much from that, but what a great person. And I think it's great in the business. But to talk about the people you're working with, fantastic. I'm sure you have other projects to tell us about, and especially this season premiere again. So you're, again, the red carpet's on October 9th. Is that one, again, the season premiering again for The Walking Dead? Am I correct?
That's the that's the premiere event, and then the first episode will be on television on the 11th, which is Sunday.
October 11th. Okay. Well, fantastic. Well, are you gonna definitely live tweet? That's going to take you to the next level. I bet you could. Have you ever live tweeted the show? If you haven't, you probably could double your Twitter following in weeks. Really?
All right. Well, I'll do that. I'm learning about Twitter.
I was live tweeting for one of my people in social media for this 90 Day Fiance last night, and it was so buzzing. Up so many more followers. So definitely, that's the major thing to connect with your fans, especially when it's happening. It's wild. It is. So I don't know if you are, but push, baby, think about that. Live tweeting Sunday night. I'll be definitely checking it out. Again, best place you can find information on you, Ann. Where can we go?
You can go to my Twitter account, which is at Annie Moho, AnnieMoho, or you can also look at my website, which has my blog. I even talk about my teaching of kids there. It's ann-mahoney.com. So A-N-N, no E.
Well, fantastic. Definitely, we're going to tune in Sunday, and I'm going to have you back on the show again, especially have a connection with somebody who wrote a 9/11 book and to talk about the stories of 9/11 and you living through that situation as well. And then Hurricane Katrina. You have a lot of interesting things, but check out your website, your social media. And I bet you, if you go ahead and reach out, you're going to get that Twitter verification, especially if you're going to have the roles going to continue to evolve this season, right? Am I correct?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, you wouldn't be going to the premiere if it wasn't. So definitely enjoy yourself. Best of luck, and I really appreciate you calling and taking the time in your busy schedule to talk to me. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me. This was a real delight.
All right, take care now. Thanks again.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, that was the Total Celebrity Show. Take care, guys, and we'll talk very soon. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, Toltutor.net, for more information, Twitter, Toltutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley, and also on Periscope, at Total Tutor. I'm still smarting from the loss last night, Chicago Cubs beating my Pirates. It was a very, very, very disappointing day for Pittsburgh fans, and, you know, it is what it is, another season. I'm excited, first of all, to welcome the program, my co-host, Just Two Choices Celebrity Segment, Rico Rakowski. Rico, how are you?
High vibes, Tina Neil. I'm doing well, but I feel like you do. There's always next season for better choices for the Bucks.
And you were just thinking you had your dream. You thought that they're going to win, and I just didn't feel it. I didn't feel it with Jake Arrieta.
Yeah, well, there's just two choices, and I invested my choice in the Pirates going and making it. So I'll make another choice next time. So. You know, it's truly an honor to have with us today the electrifying and greatest football player in the University of Nebraska's history. You know, he's selected by Sports Illustrated to be the Nebraska football player of the century. We're not talking about the year or 10 years, you know, or decade. We're talking about of the century. Heisman Trophy winner and College Football Hall of Famer and Pro Football Hall of Famer, the speedsters, Johnny the Jet Rogers. Johnny, welcome to the show. Me and Neil really appreciate your being here.
Well, thanks a lot, Rico. I appreciate being on and those accolades you've given me. They used to call me the Jet, and now I'm just a prop plane.
You know, you never lose it once you got it, Johnny, so I'm sure you're still the Jet.
Well, I just had a total knee replacement here last month, and so I'm a little wounded, but I'm getting back in the game.
All right.
Well, we'll call you Bionic Jet from here on out.
Yeah, we'll go ball steel.
Can't beat it, man. They got fan blades and jet engines made out of that stuff, too. So it's the greatest. And you know, speaking of great things, you know, one of the first things, Johnny, that jumps out after seeing all of your superhuman accomplishments before the knee replacement, you know, in football is your sense of community, you know, for where you grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, from, you know, attending – Omaha's Technical High School, on to the University of Nebraska Cornhuskers, the CFL, the NFL. Now you're full circle back to Omaha with your business and stuff. So seeing this full circle sense of community that you have for Omaha and for the state of Nebraska, you know, I'm just curious, what were some of the other universities' tempting offers that tried to pull you away or recruit you away from the University of Nebraska, because they had a grip on you? What were some of the other ones you could share with us?
Well, Neil, I can't really remember a lot of the schools. I do remember I had the 50 different offers. I was intent
wow.
myself on going to USC. I had gotten mm-hmm. drafted by the Los Angeles Dodgers to play baseball, and I had went out
wow.
to try out for the baseball team at the Dodgers, which I did make the team. But my dad,
wow.
Who lived in California at the time, had took me out and around town, and he took me over to the Coliseum, and he showed me the Coliseum and told me that Ernie Davis was the first African-American to win the Heisman Trophy, and Mike
mm-hmm.
Garrett was the second African-American to win the Heisman Trophy.
Oh,
he
wow.
went to SC.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
then O.J. Simpson was the third African-American to win the Heisman Trophy, and he went to SC. And I was trying to have a dream of getting $100,000, and the Dodgers only had offered me $25,000 a year. And so
mm-hmm.
I thought that if I could get to SC, that I might be able to get $100,000. So I didn't take any of the other universities really serious at all because I was trying
mm-hmm.
to get to USC. And actually, I didn't take Nebraska serious at all either because at
wow.
that time I think they were about 6-7 on the season.
Mm-hmm.
But they hadn't won a championship since Jesus was a kid. So I really wasn't planning on But fortunately enough, I ran into Bob Devaney when I got back, and he gave me all his
mm-hmm.
plans that he wanted to have national championships instead of Big Eight
mm-hmm.
championships, and he wanted to have All-Americans instead of Big Eight champion awards, and that if I came to the University of Nebraska, I could make all the difference in the world.
And
that was a great deal, Coach. Well, I appreciated that, but I didn't resonate initially because
mm-hmm.
I had my own plan. But
mm-hmm.
he realized that I was my first love in life was baseball, and I was going to football because I was trying to get that $100,000. But he told me that if I were to come to Nebraska, that he would allow me to play baseball and football.
Oh, wow!
Which I did.
Wow!
And at that time, it was really unheard of. That's what made me decide to come to the University of Nebraska, because he explained to me if I played baseball and football against each other, that I would have a better chance of getting that 100,000. So that was the reason why I initially went to the University of Nebraska.
Oh, wow. Well,
wow.
So you have to call Johnny Rogers the first Bo Jackson in a certain way, playing both sports in college for a major college, Johnny. How did you perform in baseball? Your career in Nebraska, as we know, how you performed in football?
Oh, I was All-American in baseball all the time. I was a switch hitter, and
wow.
I ran the bases real well. I was stealing home. I definitely had a career in baseball that was set up, is why I pursued it so heavily, because I was very good at it, and I really loved it. Josh Gibson, which is Bob Gibson's brother, was
mm-hmm.
my first and my longest baseball coach, and he had taught me all the things I had known.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to pursue baseball, but baseball really wasn't as big as football back in those days, especially for collegians. So, but for me to be able to play both sports was really a big deal. And it turned
mm-hmm.
out that a couple years later, a year or so later, Bob came back to me and told me that they wanted me to give up baseball and just to come out for football because they had all these different ways that they had to get me the ball. I said, well, Coach, that's fine, but that's not my plan. You promised me that if I came here that I could play baseball and football. And he said, yes, he said, I realize that, but think of it this way, Johnny. If you come out for football willingly and drop baseball willingly, that you would be the first person that we ever endorsed for the Heisman Trophy. And
wow.
So I took the deal, and I became the fourth African American to win the Heisman Trophy.
Mm-hmm.
So it all worked out.
Wow!
That definitely seemed like it worked out for you, Johnny. But again, never would have thought two sport athlete Rico Wright. When we were researching Johnny, Wikipedia, they didn't really talk much about baseball. Did you know about his baseball career, Rico?
No, I found out about his College Football National Player Award, you know, the Jet Award that came out in 2011, but baseball didn't surface. You've really shed some light on that. What position were you playing?
I was All-American in baseball in high school in 1969 and got drafted to the Los Angeles Dodgers. And we had quite a good baseball team here. And I played baseball long before I started football, like I said, back with Josh Gibson. But baseball, football was just far a more popular sport, especially in Nebraska.
Wow.
Man.
Interest for sure. So we always learn new things from our guests, don't we, Rico?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'm happy about the Jet Award as well. You know, Dan Jenkins. Do you remember Dan Jenkins for Sports Illustrated?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, Dan had put out a deal back in 2009 or 10 that he did a deal for the greatest teams of all time, and he had like three different teams on it. But on that, on those three or four different teams, four teams, he had a 12th person. And he called them the return specialists. And I think it was Billy Cannon, Deion Sanders, Joe Washington, and myself. And when he wrote that, then that was the first time I'd even thought about it. And I looked in the scene, and that was the return specialist was the only category in college football that they didn't have an award for. And I couldn't believe it. And so based on the credibility that Dan Jenkins brought to the table and those four guys, and I was one of those four guys that was picked to on those all-time teams. Because when I decided to create the Jet Award and to take up that one slot that was left in college football for it, since this time that we've had four different winners, and like right now, Tyler Lockett was our last Jet Award winner, and Tyler just ran about a 100-yard touchdown back in his first NFL game, and ran a couple more in the preseason, and our award is going great because we have some of the baddest men on the planet that are actually return specialists. I mean, these guys can bring their best when it really matters the most. And that's what really makes a unique football player, is to be able to do it under pressure continuously.
Well, we're again talking to a jet, and Rico flies jets, and he's an airline pilot, Johnny. So that's a funny kind of comparison, right, Rico?
I like the analogy, and I like the idea of acceleration that you have, you know, and one of the things I found fascinating, Johnny, is that I wasn't aware that there were, you know, 45 to 50 other categories for college football, you know, national players. Most of us are familiar with, you know, we're familiar with the Maxwell Award, the Heisman Trophy, you know, the Walter Camp Award and those kinds of things. But, you know, the Archie Griffin Award, there's the Jerry Rice Award, the Jim Thorpe, you know, Paul Hornung. And so, I really like what's happened here, what's evolved, and you just have to kind of smile. Here you were in baseball, just trying to find your way into college sports, and you end up having this Jet Award named for you in a category in a sport where it was really your 1B out of the sports, you know, with your 1AB in baseball.
Yeah, well, I was just really amazed that they didn't have any award for the return specialist. When you know they're game breakers, they're some of the most exciting guys in football. But I remember though clearly when I came up playing football, from the time I played Pop Warner to almost in the pros, got it on those times, that special teams, the guys on the special teams, the ran back punts and kickoff, we always picked the guys who were not on the first team or on offensive defense.
Right.
At Nebraska, we took our first team, our best players on offense and our best players on defense, and we put them together, and we called that our special team. And that team's job was to get good field position, and that's pretty much what we did. And Coach Osborne figured out that every time that we got the ball past our 40-yard line on a punt return or a kickoff, that we scored 75% of the time. And when we blew, we only scored 10% of the time. So we made it our business to really put an emphasis on special teams. But I remember that all the guys that didn't get to play and there weren't really good players, more times than not, were always put on special teams. So special team was almost like being on second team.
Yeah.
And now it turns out, when you see it now, that These are the game breakers. These are the guys that are making the 100-yard touchdowns and really turning the game around in a second through their athleticisms. And it's turned out to be a big deal, but that category stayed open for all of my career until I was out of the game 20, 30, 40 years before I filled it with the Johnny the Jet Rogers National College Football Return Specialist Award. And now we call it for short the Jet Award.
Now, see, I find that so important because you know certain special teams, kickoff returners or punt returners, change the game completely. If you have someone so dominant, basically you give up. To think of Virginia Tech and how they spent so much time in special teams in their successful years, that was the big, you know, that game breaker, that they put their time and effort into special teams. But you think of these guys, think about Tim Brown and how he changed the game through special teams, and specifically just these guys that just literally changed the direction where you don't want to kick the ball to that person. And then you even see it in the NFL with certain NFL players that say, even though they're a top wide receiver, I'm going to return punts, or they got to start returning kickoffs. So it's an important award for sure, Johnny.
Oh, yeah, it's a very important award, and like I said, there's some of the baddest men on the planet are punt return and kickoff return guys, and they're game breakers. And it's like I said, Tyler Lockett just ran one back in his very first game in the NFL to point that, and they made a point to let him know that I don't think they're going to kick it to him again today.
Well, you bring up an
interesting... We know we're not going to do it now.
Well, they're just two choices, kick it to them or not. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is, Neil, if you follow up on this too, you know, we interviewed Ralph Sindrich, and he made a comment, you know, from going from player to agent, you know, long ago, and he played for, you know, he played for the University of Pittsburgh. He said it was such a switch going to the pros, and the pros had already had something like that established where special teams was something, you know, as opposed to perhaps – what you discovered or what you guys put together at Nebraska in order to come together with your first ever national championship, with that specialty being built in with your speed and acceleration. So it was interesting for him to mention that. What do you think, Neil?
I think it's a great question.
I think football is made up of offense, defense, and special teams, and you have to put a third of your time on each category to be successful. Mm-hmm. Everyone is equally important. You have to be balanced in all different areas, all those three areas, to have a complete football team.
Well, the Steelers lost a game against the Ravens because of their kicker, and that's special teams, and that was they shouldn't have lost that game. And so you're right.
Yep.
And then we could just talk about teams that have terrible punters or – you know, or not covering kickoffs well, it kills you. But it starts the momentum is special teams. And Johnny, playing all those positions, not just, you know, just being, you know, you were involved in a lot of different things. Was that a surprise to you to be involved in special teams, not just the overall offense for the Nebraska Cornhuskers? They tried to get you the ball anytime they could.
Well, we had such a balanced football team I didn't really expect really to get the ball a lot as far as running the ball. We had a good eye back in Jeff Kinney, Billy Olds, the stable fullback. He ran quite a bit at the time. We had other receivers that were pretty good. To be balanced, I had to get the ball on punt returns and kickoffs to make up for the times that I didn't get it. But I did play wing back, and I played wide receiver, and I played running back. I actually threw for touchdown passes, too. And I was what you would call the utility back. They just used me all over because it would make the defense have to make those adjustments that they weren't really equipped to be able to make those adjustments very quickly. And we didn't do it all the time, so they didn't practice a lot. So whenever we did do something different or a trap or something from the wing back position, they just weren't ready for it. They just weren't ready for it.
Who in college football or pro football after you, Johnny, reminds you of you that has become pretty high pro all those different positions to get so that they could get the ball to them? Who would you say will remind you after your time in in the NFL or NCAA or college football that was as versatile as you were?
Well, right now, just thinking about it in the near recent past is Abdullah from Nebraska played that that type of role, and I think DeMornay right now, he's probably the best punt return kickoff guy that I've experienced as close to having those skills that I've had. And they're going to start using him just like did Abdullah at different positions in the backfield to be able to get him the ball more too. So I think it's coming back to that utility back person that you can get him that ball several different type of ways to make defense have to adjust to him. And to see that really puts a burden on the defense because they can't bring in a different player to cover you from all those different positions up quick enough. So it puts them at a weakness.
That's great. That's definitely a great comparison. I agree.
Well, and you know what? And when you were back at the University of Nebraska,
Ishmael,
there, Johnny.
Ishmael the Rocket. You remember the Rocket? Ishmael Rocket?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
going way back, he was right there, too.
Thought here with regard to the national championship team you guys had with, the game of the century. Did it take a couple of years to develop this strategy, or was it just something that clicked in the one season, and then you carried it on after that in terms of these specialties that you were talking about and the punt returns and the run backs on the kickoffs and that? Was it earlier on? It takes some time to develop it?
Well, I think when they recruited me, when I actually got recruited to Nebraska, they didn't quite have that in mind because they promised me baseball. When they after we got involved and they seen how many different things I really could do well, I think that was in Devaney's mind. Looking forward is why he asked me to give up baseball because, quoting him, they just had so many different ways they wanted to get me the ball. They had thought about it what that would kind of a difference that would make on the defenses. And so that's why they made me the deal to quit baseball in order to be able to do all the things that I was able to do that Coach Osborne and Devaney actually put a lot of thought into that. So they were the brainchild of it. I was capable. I've done all those things for a lot of different years on a lower level. But when you get to Division I football and the caliber that we have at Nebraska in the Big Eight where we were playing, that you had to come up with something different. That was very different at the time for someone to be able to use as a utility back and to be able to do those each thing equally as well, including being able to throw passes because I had played quarterback as a Pop Warner.
Johnny, how do you feel that you were the first to kind of carry the baton in Nebraska football history, meaning when you guys won the national championship in 1972, it really led to – I wouldn't say a dynasty, but something led to a tradition in Nebraska football that was unlike any tradition up to Tom Osborne that you guys created through your movement in 72. Do you agree?
Like you said, we did it. I think it was the time that we really had a balanced football team. One of the things that they had made clear to me earlier that they were going to recruit more African-Americans that would be playing at that time than they had ever had before. And if you follow history back, there really weren't a lot of African-Americans playing in groups at that particular time. When we played LSU for our first national championship in 1970, they didn't have any African-Americans playing on their team. And when we played Alabama the next year, they only had one African-American playing. I don't think he actually started. So a lot of the people in the South remember that we had Nebraska because of Willie Harper and Billy Owens and Richard Glover. And we had 13, 14, 15 different African-Americans on there that we were the beginning of integration for football in the South because when we were so effective and had so much speed, that Bear Bryant went out and just said he just had to go out and get him some African-Americans. And now you look at the Alabama team and they're inundated with a lot of African-Americans because it represents the speed that they need to have. And because we represented that as a team and we did so well, then people started to catch on and it gave a lot more opportunity for African-Americans to be able to collaborate with white guys to amplify what teamwork really means. And we worked so well together that it really was tough. You remember John Dutton, don't you?
Yes.
You remember John Dutton that played for the Dallas Cowboys?
Yes.
John played second team in Nebraska.
Oh, wow.
He couldn't start. If you can imagine that, he didn't start.
Good.
He had so much talent that guys like John Dutton didn't start. Monty Johnson was another big name. He didn't start. He was on second team.
You had a fabulous team, Rico. That was a fabulous team.
Yeah.
I interviewed also Bob Newton that played for Nebraska. Tremendous guy.
Right.
And he was an unbelievable offensive lineman. And he was an All-American with and he went to Johnny. Where did all the All-Americans go to when I was on the every year that you were you visited? Where I forget who who's the famous person? Bob Hope, right? Where you were introduced by Bob Hope?
Oh, Bob Hope Show. Yes. Bob Hope All-American. Yes.
You remember that, Rico?
Yeah, I have a picture.
Yeah,
I have a picture with Bob Hope now that we put on my Facebook here not long ago.
Wow.
I put Bob Newton's. It got so many likes. After I interviewed Bob Newton, I found a picture of Bob with Bob Hope, and that got over so big time. Oh my gosh, Rico, you wouldn't believe it.
Oh yeah, Bob Newton was a huge offensive tackle in those days. So we had when they weren't. He was one of the big guys before they became big. He played for Nebraska. He was a junior college transfer that came with us. We had several junior college transfers that came in there in 1969, 70, 71, and our freshman team came up with Richie Glover and Willie Harper, and we all came up at the same time. And like I said, in 67, 68, they hadn't won anything, but 69, we were Big Eight champs for the first time in a long time. And then we went on to win back-to-back national championships.
Yep, and that's unheard of when you were thinking of going to FC. That's interesting, Rico, right?
Yep, and you know, I like what also you were talking about before, Johnny, with regard to, now, you were talking about African Americans coming into sports and opportunity, and Neil and I are both strong believers in education. Of course, Neil has a Total Education Network, and my background is, besides flying, is working with kids. And you know, when you talk about opportunity, could you share with us some of the things that you share education-wise with regard to encouraging athletes to stay in school, or even just to kids who you brought in to ask to talk to different groups and to mentor and stuff like that? What's some of the really, really nuggets of wisdom that you share with kids now with regard to opportunity and philosophy of life?
Well, we really believe right now that the mentoring program that we have, that like Tom Osborne's teammate program, for instance, is a big asset for our community and around the country that we're trying to move, because we have so many broken homes and guys that don't have examples. And kids don't really do what you say. They do what they see you doing. So you have to have somebody around that has actually done some things that can actually lay out a map for you that you can follow, so either it doesn't take you 10 years of your life to figure it out, to make the ups and downs or the rights and wrongs, that they can give you a map that you can actually go to. And we all know we have to have education, because education is not part of your life. Education is life itself. Yeah, but everybody's not really able to get the same type of traditional type educations that we push kids for these days. So I have my Johnny Rogers Youth Foundation. I push to get more kids into the trades. I came from technical high school with a trade school. And most everybody at Tech, we started at Horace Mann or in Tech in the trades in the seventh grade. And by the time that you got to be a senior, you were really proficient at whatever that trade was. And that everybody that came out, whether you can get into the unions or not, to move on, that you were going to be self-sufficient in life because you had a trade. And I believe now that the trades are probably the quickest way back to the middle class, because I can give a kid a scholarship for $1,000 and a Pell Grant, and they're able to go to school all year long.
Great.
And they can earn money on their job while they learn. We got plumbers. And you could be a plumber, electrician, or something like that. And those guys make as much money as doctors. So you really have an opportunity. There's all different type of educations, but you just have to, everybody, God make everybody good at something. You just got to choose that one thing you really want to be good at and find a mentor to help you along. But everybody has to be walked through something once. You can't just go out there and just do it. No matter how easy it seems or how smart you think you really are, everybody has to be walked through something, everything one time. And it really helps you to have a mentor or somebody who has walked that walk and talked that talk and been that road before to give you some guidance along the way there.
That's fantastic, Johnny, for sure. And, Johnny, I guess winning that Heisman Trophy, it's something that you'll never forget, having that opportunity to be part of a club that you probably it's just something that'll always stick with you, being the Heisman Trophy winner, correct?
Everyone. That there's only about 80 guys right now in the fraternity. And when you have something that there's only one, you pick one a year in all of college football, which millions of guys that are out there, the chances that you win in are slim and none. So to be able to be one of the unique ones, you really have to have some type of grace from God or to be lucky or to be in the right place at the right time. And to show appreciation for that, being in that position, you need to try to give back because it is something unique and special, and it keeps getting better as time goes on. It takes you a while to really appreciate really what you got. When you first win it, like 40 years ago, it was just another award. 40 years later, it's an honor and a privilege, and it's not really an individual award. It's a Heisman Trophy is a team. It should be given to the whole team because they're responsible for getting it. There's no way in the world if I could have won a Heisman Trophy by myself. It was because of the Ricky Plovers and the Willie Harpers and the John Duttons and Demonte Johnsons, Larry Jacobsons, Jerry Tagge, and all those guys. And we came together at the right place at the right time under the leadership of Coach Bob Devaney, who had Tom Osborne supporting him. Everything just came together at the right time, and we had the attitude that we weren't giving up and we wanted to win. Bob told me one time, he said, in Nebraska, winning isn't everything, but we do rate it right up there with oxygen.
That's so true, definitely. Absolutely. And, Johnny, our final question we have is a survey that Rico has conducted with many different celebrities. So, Rico, tell him about our survey. Go ahead.
Well, I have to thank you, Johnny, for delivering that on a platter. Right up there with oxygen is the subject of choice. And you can't escape it in every moment. As I look at it with this just two choices philosophy, you're either going to make a choice that's going to take you closer to what you want, you know, smaller, greater, or could take you away from what you want. So, you know, choice is primal. How do you look at life? What percentage of life do you see as choice, and what percentage of life do you see as circumstance? There's no right or wrong answer to it. We're just, you know, philosophically trying to see how people feel about this this idea.
Well, I don't think they just happened. Choice has a lot to be involved. There's people out here right now who have goals. You know, you have to have goals. And I do believe in goals. That sets up what your choices are, but the people who really make it make decisions, like choices. And the people who, when you make a decision that you're going to do something, you're not setting up for a goal that you hope you do. You made a decision that you made that choice that this is what I'm going to do. And you get it done subconsciously, you just go do it. And that's the big difference between goals and decisions or choices. But I think the emphasis in my mind would have to go to your choices. Because once you make a choice and decision, you burn the bridges and the ships and whatever, you go do what you got to do. And you never give up until you really get it done. And you realize that every day is game day.
Yeah, well, if you had to pick a percentage, you said, how much is choice and how much is circumstance? What percentage would you give to choice for our listeners as a thought to keep in mind? And what percentage do you say is circumstance? 90%.
He said 90%. 90-10. 90-10. All right. Wow. Oh, awesome. Okay. Awesome. Johnny, is there a place
Without
we can find
doubt.
Information on you and your foundation and all the other stuff? Where can we go?
Well, I don't know. Well, we have probably some on my website, but it needs to be updated. We're doing some updates on it now because things are changing. JohnnyJetRogers.com. But okay. You can Google this. There's more stuff out there on Wikipedia or wherever that you can take you a week to read it all. I mean, sometimes I have to go there myself.